At KPMG, our people make the difference. It's not just something we say, it's what we do. Combining the power of people and technology, we uncover brighter insights, innovate bolder solutions, and create better data-driven outcomes. KPMG, make the difference.
You ever meet someone who seems kind of off? Whether it's a creepy neighbor or a random phone number that keeps calling you, Truthfinder has you covered. You can search for people by name, address, phone number, email, and more. Truthfinder can be especially helpful for running confidential background checks on anyone you're planning to meet from online dating apps. Go to truthfinder.com/podcasts for a special offer. That's truthfinder.com/podcasts to access your special offer today.
The first degree.
First degree.
First degree.
First degree.
First degree.
First degree.
The first degree.
These things are supposed to happen in movies, not in real life.
At that time, kids would just go play. They would be going to their friends, and they would just meet their friend in the street and just, okay, I'll go over your house. They didn't even just tell their mommy, I'm going over so-and-so's house. And then after, they might go over somebody else's house, and it was very free. I didn't think anything of it until about an hour after. But then I says, well, maybe she forgot. But then something in me started, and then before you knew it, I was starting to call people. And then I was asking, you know, around. I said, did Joan come here? She came here to deliver cookies. He said, no. He was just pure evil. Pure, pure evil. Evil could be so subtle, and his evil is subtle. Thank God I did it. That's what gives me such joy. If I didn't do it, I would have not felt the way I feel now, being a voice.
Welcome to The First Degree, the true crime podcast that you might end up on. My name is Jack Vanek. I'm sitting here with Alexis Linkletter. What's up, Lex?
What's up, Jack?
What are you doing?
Just over here in the office, straight chilling.
Straight chilling, looking at me through a screen.
That's right.
Another episode of The First Degree. We are just talking about our guest for today's episode and how sweet she was when you interviewed her, Lex. Do you want to just like give our listeners a little, like let them know what a sweetie pie she was?
Yeah, honestly, Rosemary is a firecracker. She's not to be messed with. She gets stuff done. But she's also this wholesome, wonderful person in that she's like, hey, so in my episode, maybe not with the cursing, because you know how Jack and I get very impassioned about what we're talking about. And that's really only the only context in which we curse.
Yeah.
You know, if we're calling someone bleeping disgusting or bleeping evil, that's sort of when we get riled up, we tend to sort
it's an
of
adjective.
Sound like sailors at times. But Rosemary said, no, not in this one. That's not her vibe. So we're respecting that. We love you, Rosemary.
Today is a clean episode with the cursing. Before we start today's episode, if you're looking for more true crime content, join us over on our Patreon. We have an extra episode every single week, full true crime episode that you listeners, our lovely firsties, are recommending, and we're crowdsourcing it over there.
That's right. It's good stuff over there, so definitely join us. And especially if you're out of stuff to binge here on the main feed, we've got, I don't know, 100 so episodes many. Over there. So we're there. We're ready to satisfy your needs.
We are ready. All right. Well, I think that is enough of that. So let's turn down the lights.
And turn up your anxiety.
Because this could be you.
For all the faults of modern technology, the unsavory side of social media, the sad influence of our 24-hour news cycle on our psyches, as negative as all these things can be, they're the same tools that have revolutionized law enforcement's ability to solve crimes. When you learn of the scant resources the police had back in the day to disseminate information far and wide quickly, you can really appreciate how lucky we are to live in a time of these modern advances. These days, parents have apps in their phones to track their kids, to track the number of registered sex offenders in their neighborhoods. We have so many tools at our fingertips to help keep our kids safe. But 50 years ago, things were very, very different. Those memes where Gen Xers talk about running around the local neighborhood and parents not having to be concerned knowing where their kids were, they're 100% true. Parents had no idea just how many predators there were lurking on the same streets as their children were playing. And let's be clear, these people, these monsters, they need to live somewhere, and it could be right next to you.
We begin today's case on April 19th of 1973. Under President Richard Nixon, the last American troops fighting the Vietnam War had just arrived home following a ceasefire agreement. But the president himself was in a lot of hot water as a federal grand jury convened to determine his role in the infamous Watergate scandal. On the Billboard charts, the song "Tie a Yellow Ribbon Round the Ole Oak Tree" by Dawn featuring Tony Orlando was in the top spot, closely followed by number two, "The Night the Lights Went Out in Georgia" by Vicki Lawrence. I haven't heard of either of these songs. Have you?
Yes, you have.
I have.
You just the "Lights Going Out in Georgia" one, you've definitely heard.
Oh.
And probably "Tie a Yellow Ribbon Round the Old Oak Tree," probably.
If it was the number one song at some point, I'm sure I have. But yeah, those titles are not speaking to me at all.
Right.
At the movie's dystopian thriller, Soylent Green was a top grossing film, with moviegoers also keen to see the one and only Clint Eastwood direct and star in the hit Western High Plains Drifter.
And the setting for today's case is Hillsdale, New Jersey. Situated in the north of the state, in the Pascack Valley region of Bergen County, the borough of around 10,000 people is located 25 miles north of the city of Newark. Like much of eastern New Jersey, Hillsdale is still considered to be part of the greater New York City metropolitan area. And being a small place, Hillsdale is popular with families who enjoy the tight-knit sense of community, a friendly vibe, and excellent nearby schools. It's perhaps best known for Demarest Farms, where you can pick your own apples, pumpkins, and peaches, visit the farm's petting zoo, the farmer's market, and even see their annual Halloween light show. Hillsdale is also where our first degree for today's case, Rosemary, who we've already told you about, raised her family. Rosemary and her husband Frank had five children, including her middle child, Joan, who was born on September 7th of 1965. And Hillsdale was the perfect spot for this growing family. Kids felt safe playing outside in a place where everyone knew each other, as cliche as all of that sounds.
At that time in the 70s, things were free. People would say hello to each other. Kids would just go play. They would be going to their friends, and they would just meet their friend in the street and just, okay, I'll go over your house. They didn't even tell their mommy, I'm going over so-and-so's house. Or maybe at the beginning they would, and then after they might go over somebody else's house. And it was very free.
By the spring of 1973, 7-year-old Joan was in second grade and about to make her first communion. According to Rosemary, Joan had a spunky personality, a brilliant sense of humor, and was full of light. She had a strong sense of social justice, even at 7 years old, and was caring and so inclusive of others around her. She demonstrated characteristics of a true leader even at her really young age.
Right, and Joan's favorite colors were green and orange. She loved playing outside amongst the spring daffodils, and she was also a dog lover.
But Joan also had an adventurous spirit and wasn't afraid to try new things like ice skating or jumping off the highest diving board. Outside of attending the local Catholic school and church, Joan was also a keen ballet dancer who loved music.
She was a feisty little girl. She was kind. She was sensitive to others. She was the type of girl that would do something, not just talk. And it didn't matter if it was going to be hard. She was a leader. She was social, very good with music, very good at dancing, quite compassionate. Like one of her classmates was left out of the group, and it was just a child just watching and wanted to be in the group. She would notice that child, and she would say, come, come play. The ballet teacher, she said that she would be the first on the line. And she said, not because she was going to be the first on the line. And No, she did it because let's do the job, let's get it done, not because of self-importance.
But one of the things Joan was most passionate about was becoming a Girl Scout brownie.
My sister was in the Girl Scouts. Joan joined in the first grade, but she wanted to join because her friends were joining. and she wanted to be a little brownie. To her, that was going to be a fun thing and a social thing.
Of course, one of the big events on the scouting calendar was the annual Girl Scout cookie sale, which, ugh, I'm really craving a Thin Mint. That sounds so good.
Honestly, what do they call it now? A coconut delight?
What
it used to be called a Samoa.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
I think that became politically incorrect. So they changed it to coconut delight, which same delicious cookie.
Delightful.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't say no to a Thin Mint, but I'm a mint gal.
I love Thin Mints too.
So good. Throw them in
a
the freezer.
A tag-along? They're honestly all amazing. They've really nailed the cookie game.
They're so good. So we all understand what the Girl Scout cookie sale is. And Rosemarie had rules for Joan about selling the cookies herself. She was to deliver them with another little girl so she wasn't by herself. And I think that obviously is a really good rule.
It's a great rule. In that year, Joan had sold and dropped off all of the cookies that she had sold to those in the neighborhood. That was except for two boxes, which were to be delivered to one of her neighbors nearby.
There were four blocks where the two girls could go sell and where they would have to deliver. I told them I didn't want them to go more than that. It was different then. The children were going around by themselves. So I had the two of them going together. And they went to all the neighbors. There were two boxes left. And they had gone in the morning to deliver together. My sister had gone on her bicycle to go to play softball. Her brother, 2 years older, was going on the other side of Florence Street to play with a friend. So Joan was by herself. She was outside on the front lawn and just frolicking and playing and just having fun outdoors because she liked nature a lot.
Around 2:45 p.m. on April 19th, Joan told her mom she was going to deliver those last two boxes to their neighbor. She didn't really have to go far and would be back super soon. And Joan was on a mission. She ran a short distance down the street toward the nearest cross street.
She comes into the house. She's very excited. And she said, I'm going to go. I'm Joan. Very fast. So she took them. She went. I see she had a ponytail, bopping, everything very fast. I remember her excitement. Here she was. She was going to get the job done because that's the way Joan was. She was going to be doing the job, and, hey, she was being an independent little girl. So you have this happy little child, and then she's, bye, Mommy. Okay, bye, Joan. At that time, there wasn't vigilance.
But as the minutes and then hours passed, Joan didn't come home. At first, Rosemarie assumed her daughter had run into a friend and gone playing. But by 6 p.m., she was beginning to panic.
I didn't think anything of it until about an hour after. But then I says, well, maybe she forgot. But then something in me started. And then before you knew it, I was starting to call people. And then I was asking, you know, around. When her father came back, they started going around with the car. When she was out for 2 hours, even more playing. But this was different. Something was different.
Rosemarie went to the McGowan house, three houses down and only 100 yards away. There she asked 26-year-old Joseph, who lived there with his mother and grandmother, if he'd seen Joan. He said he hadn't, and then he pretty much shut the door in Rosemarie's face. How rude.
I didn't know him personally. I just saw him once. And my children, they knew, you know, he was the neighbor in that house. About 10 to 7, I said, I'm going to ask him if he saw Joan. So I asked him, and he said no. And he was very, very stiff. His face hardly moved when he said no. I said, did Joan come here? She came here to deliver the cookies. He said no. And I started getting tears. And you know what he did? He wanted to get away from me. And he didn't say anything. He just looked at me and went away.
Just imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials. Just imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach. We're talking things like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for just $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. And listen to this, the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. We love that. And besides having incredible luxury clothing items like cashmere sweaters, they also have awesome housewares. But this cashmere sweater that I got from Quince, I get so many compliments on it, and I paid significantly less than I would almost anywhere else. It's time to indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/first for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, quince.com/first to get free shipping and 365-day return. That's quince.com/first.
Okay, so it comes as no surprise that I have absolutely no idea how to cook. I don't want to learn how to cook. It's not really my thing. But when I tried Factor Meals, it was a freaking game changer. So Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are dietitian approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Yeah, 2 minutes. So no matter how busy you are, you'll always have time to enjoy nutritious, great tasting meals. So the first time I tried Factor Meals, I was actually blown away because I'm like, that's it. That's all it is. 2 minutes. And the meals are so delicious. With 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons to choose from every single week, you'll always have new flavors to explore. And you can treat yourself to restaurant quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon. Ooh, fancy. Shrimp and blackened salmon. Like I said, they're so easy to prepare. I love them. So head to factormeals.com/degree50 and use code degree50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code degree50 at factormeals.com/degree50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active.
At 7:15 p.m., Rosemary and her husband Frank called the police, and a massive search for Joan ensued. The entire Hillsdale community and those surrounding quickly rallied to help. 500 personnel from 5 fire departments and 15 law enforcement agencies and volunteers took to the fields, woods, farms, waterways, and also went from door to door in an intense search for Joan. This included New York State Police bloodhounds, the Bergen County dive team, and a helicopter. Even off-duty police officers arrived to help with the search effort. Frank and Rosemary also issued a public appeal saying no charges would be laid if Joan was returned home unharmed.
But there was no sign of little Joan. Still, the search continued with the D'Alessandro's neighbors, all of them helping, including neighbor Joseph McGowan, who had been the customer Joan was delivering cookies to when she vanished.
Then, on Easter Sunday, 3 days after Joan was last seen, there was a tragic development. Palisades Parkway police found her behind a boulder in a wooded area, 100 feet off Route 210 in Harriman State Park, Rockland County, over the border in New York, just 15 miles north of Joan's house.
It was clear that Joan had been the victim of a violent homicide. Her clothing lay 100 feet away from her body and was also found in a parking area several miles away.
My father and I knew that she wasn't coming back, even though I'd keep 1% there that she was. But we didn't say anything. We just knew.
News of the perverse, cruel, and violent nature of Joan's slaying rightfully resulted in an explosion of outrage and sorrow that permeated the community. The wall-to-wall media coverage of what was now a murder case had everyone on edge, calling for retribution.
So who could have done something so sickening and incomprehensible? And why? To find out what happened and who did this, you know the drill, we gotta go back.
When Joan first disappeared, the first point of call for police was the D'Alessandro's neighbors. Surely they'd seen something. Local officers had some ideas about potential suspects based on their inquiries, observing people's behavior, and taking note of their responses to their door knocks.
And soon, one of those men stood out, Joseph McGowan, the man who lived at the house Joan was bringing those last two boxes of Girl Scout cookies to when she disappeared. The same Joseph McGowan who also aided in the foot search of Joan. Turns out, when Hillsdale police spoke to him a second time at the police station, while Joan was still missing, they noticed inconsistencies in his version of events about his movements on the day of her disappearance. Yet, Joseph denied knowing anything about where Joan was. The young man agreed to take a polygraph test, but when he failed and then he asked to see a priest, investigators knew they were onto something.
Right, and the priest spent some time with Joseph, listening to him talk. And when the clergyman emerged from the room, he told detectives, quote, "Fellas, keep questioning him." It was only a matter of time before Joseph confessed to police, telling them where they could find Joan's body.
He says, "I'm fine, and I'll fool the lie detector test." And then he eventually told the police. They arrested him on Easter Sunday.
Joseph's confession is what led the police to head out to Harriman State Park, where Joan's body was found.
He told them where Joan's body was, and thank God we did get her. It was 3 days, but we found her. Because Harriman State Park is huge. It would take a long time to find her.
We know it's not uncommon for child predators to participate in a search for a child who is still missing, primarily so they don't draw attention to themselves. But the knowledge that Joan's killer was directly involved in searching for the missing girl is absolutely sickening.
So, who was Joseph McGowan? Part of what rocked the community to its very core was that he was a quiet, unassuming, devoutly Catholic high school science teacher with no criminal record. Born around 1946, Joseph was an only child and grew up with his parents in the nearby town of Creskill. After graduating from Ten Fly High School, he went on to major in chemistry at Montclair State College.
Around 1967, when Joseph's father passed away and he finished college, he moved back in with his mother. Joseph soon became engaged to another teacher, and in 1970, he, his mother, and his grandmother moved to Hillsdale. The engagement ended not long afterward. By the spring of 1973, Joseph was teaching at Tappan Zee High School in Orangeburg, New York.
And he was a teacher working with children, with kids. You know, he's intelligent, he's educated.
So the question is, what happened? How could Joan go from happily delivering cookies one minute to falling victim to a monster the next? Joseph later told a psychiatrist that when Joan walked into his house after he opened the door, he grabbed the young girl and forced her into his downstairs bedroom while his 87-year-old grandmother was still upstairs. His intention was clear. He intended to sexually assault her, which is what he did.
And we'll let Rosemary explain what happened. And we do want to warn that some of the following details may be distressing.
I had told her beforehand it's best not to go into the house. But he said he was able to lure her because he was a teacher. You can imagine how scared she was because he told her to take her clothes off. And it seems like the laces on the sneakers, and she was left-handed, and I know I would have to help her, you know, with her tying. They still were unlaced. Those he probably pulled off. He was trying to grape her.
McGowan told the psychiatrist that at this point he suddenly realized what he'd done. In his mind, if he let Joan go, his life was over. Here's Rosemary again.
She fought as much as she could. But then he said she couldn't scream much while I'm strangling her. And then after, I mean, I'm going to share this because I want you to understand how he really wanted to take every ounce out of her. He first tried strangling her, and then after, it wasn't really working. And then what he did, he took her like a little rag doll by the feet, and he struck her head on the vinyl asphalt tile, and he wanted to really, really get rid of her. And that was on Holy Thursday. I was not knowing all this was happening. She was by herself. She was there with this person that was the darkness of any human being. He was just pure evil. Pure, pure evil. Evil could be so subtle, and his evil is subtle.
McGowan told detectives that he then concealed Joan with a plastic bag and an old couch cover tied the bundle with cord, placed her body in the trunk of his car, and then worked to clean up the scene, which is where this monster lived with his mother and his grandmother. Then he drove 50 miles to Harriman State Park, where he went down an incline. He hid her remains under a rock ledge before disposing of the plastic bags and the couch cover in a roadside garbage can. He then returned to his home and joined everybody else in the frantic search for Joan.
McGowan was charged with first-degree murder and initially held in Bergen County Jail in Hackensack on $50,000 bail. But this was soon revoked after a slew of angry calls from the public to the prosecutor's office were made. Following his indictment, McGowan was ordered by the court to undergo a series of psychiatric evaluations.
And meanwhile, Joan's autopsy had revealed that the young girl had died of strangulation and multiple blunt force head injuries sustained in an apparent beating. She had also been sexually assaulted.
Of course, Joan's family was inconsolable, trying to make sense of something that was completely senseless. And even though it was extremely early days in terms of the court process, Rosemary was coping by beginning to find some meaning wherever she could, leaning into her faith to help her through these darkest hours.
There was so much that was going to come out of this. I did not see this with no hope. I saw this with hope because she died on Holy Thursday. She was found on Easter. And in the Catholic doctrine, those days are very important. And most people know about Easter, hope, resurrection, or just rebirth, even if not resurrection. Oh, I said, there's something there. There's a message, a good message. Let's find out what it means. And it was only 2 weeks after she died that I was thinking that way. I saw it as a message of hope. Then what I started to do was look for a sign every day. And that helped me to work with my grief, even though I wasn't saying, oh, this is going to help me with my grief. I just saw that was helping me with my grief. So I looked for something. Oh, look at that. Look at this. Oh, look at that.
The community's loss of innocence also meant that almost overnight, Hillsdale residents became hyper-vigilant about their children's safety. Parents started driving their kids everywhere and wouldn't let them out of sight when they were at home.
But there were multiple factors at play here. One was that Hillsdale hadn't had a homicide in 18 years. The other was that people who knew Joseph McGowan were deeply shocked that he could be capable of such violence. He was quiet. He was church-going. He was a high school teacher. He resembled nothing of the boogeymen that parents warned their kids about in the 70s.
McGowan initially pleaded not guilty at his arraignment, but in early December of 1973, he ultimately pleaded guilty to murder. Court-ordered psych testing revealed that McGowan was competent at the time of the offense. He'd admitted to psychiatrists that he had a history of impulsive violent outbursts and dealt with anger in the past by breaking something.
Right, and he initially claimed that he killed Joan because he was embarrassed when he realized he didn't have the right change to pay for the cookies. That's obviously a lie, and he later admitted that it was. So it turns out this monster had a history of rape fantasies and fantasies about young girls. He also confessed to an inability to relate to women of his own age. And despite coming across to adults as conforming and conventional, McGowan had, quote, a tremendous amount of underlying unconscious hostility and repress these emotions, leading him to explode and act on impulse. So what was most concerning was that while McGowan was recounting the details of this crime during his evaluations, his emotional affect remained completely flat without revealing any particular emotions he may have been attempting to mask.
McGowan was all set to be sentenced when he returned to court in January of 1974, when suddenly everything slowed to a halt. And that's because the judge had just realized that despite it being common knowledge from the very beginning that Joan had been sexually assaulted in the course of her murder, the rape charge had somehow been left off the original indictment. And the judge wasn't going to stand for this, given the sexual assault appeared to be a key motivating factor here. The judge refused to sentence Joseph, expressing strong criticism over the glaring error. The file was returned to the prosecutor to rectify the error and bring a new indictment.
Right, and this error actually had severe implications. So if McGowan had been sentenced for pleading guilty to first-degree murder with no aggravating factors like sexual assault, he would have faced a maximum of 30 years in prison, which meant that he would have been eligible for parole in less than 5.5 years. So, huge deal. However, if he was to be convicted of rape and murder, he'd receive a life sentence. He'd still eventually be eligible for parole, but after 13 years and 9 months. So yeah, there's a big difference either way here. So it's kind of amazing that this judge caught it.
In February of 1974, Joseph was reindicted, this time on felony murder for committing murder during the course of a rape. He was now facing a mandatory life sentence, but the accused rapist and killer now changed his plea and claimed that he was not guilty.
Right. And McGowan's trial began in June of 1974. However, the day after jury selection, he was now again pleading guilty. Though his attorney went to great pains to point out his client wasn't pleading guilty to rape by itself. So it kind of seems like this sick man in his twisted mind, he was okay with being known as a child murderer, but he took issue with being known as a child rapist, which unfortunately he was.
2 months later in August, sentencing was postponed for a third time when Joseph wanted to retract his guilty plea and instead plead not guilty by reason of insanity. This was despite the fact that Joseph had previously been found both competent to stand trial and legally sane at the time of the offense. The judge had had it with Joseph's garbage delay tactics, but despite the court's desire to continue with sentencing, the defense fought for and won a postponement.
When the case finally returned to court in November of 1974, the judge rejected a defense motion to reduce the charge to second-degree murder, and Joseph McGowan was finally sentenced to life in prison.
There wasn't a trial. He pleaded guilty just to the murder, so this way he'd be out of prison and he'd be in the street sooner. But then the judge, now he said, this is also rape, and because of that, he got more punishment. But you have to remember, punishment at that time only meant 14 years. 14 years meant life. He did get life. If it just murder, he would have been up for parole in 5 years. This way with both, he was up for parole in 14 years. Still so little.
This didn't stop McGowan from appealing, though, asking the appeals court to reduce his sentence to 30 years or to be allowed to go to trial with an insanity plea. Thankfully, in December of 1975, his request was denied.
When I was growing up, I took French in high school, but I could never get the language to stick. I wanted to be fluent so bad, but it never happened. I just couldn't focus and I couldn't practice enough, and it didn't work. But thankfully, there's Rosetta Stone, which is the most trusted language learning program, and it's available on desktop or it can be used as an app on your phone or tablet. Rosetta Stone is different. It immerses you in so many ways, and with its intuitive process, you can pick up any language naturally, first with words, then phrases, and then sentences, and before you know it, boom, conversations. Plus, with Rosetta Stone's true accent feature, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronouncing words. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the First Degree listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/first. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/first today.
You ever meet someone who seems kind of off? Whether it's a creepy neighbor or random phone number that keeps calling you, Truthfinder has you covered. You can search for people by name, address, phone number, email, and more. Truthfinder can be especially helpful for running confidential background checks on anyone you're planning to meet from online dating apps. Go to truthfinder.com/podcasts for a special offer. That's truthfinder.com/podcasts to access your special offer today.
Ten years passed, and in 1987, Joseph McGowan lost his first bid for parole. But Rosemary knew this wasn't going to go away, and that she'd have to go above and beyond to ensure that the ongoing nightmare that her family was living through never happened to anyone else.
Rosemary got to work. She found a renewed sense of purpose and was going to honor Joan's legacy by advocating for change in legislation and child safety. In 1993, in the lead up to Joseph's next shot at parole, she began a grassroots campaign urging state legislators to change the law so that anybody convicted of killing a child under the age of 14 would remain in prison for life without parole. Rosemary started a petition, distributed green ribbons to raise awareness, and started talking to the media.
And that's when I started the movement that we were going to have to fight to keep the killer in prison. We were really going to have to fight.
Joseph McGowan was again denied parole in 1994, largely thanks to the 80,000 signatures that Rosemary had collected. So pause for a second. Like 80,000?
Crazy.
Doesn't seem like that much when you factor in social media and things that in campaigns that go viral. But remember, 94, she wasn't using change.org or GoFundMe or anything to help her collect these. This was a physical collection of 80,000 signatures. Like, it's kind of mind-blowing.
It is.
When you think about how much effort and energy that took.
Several years later, retired FBI behavioral analyst John Douglas took an interest in the case. He actually met with Joseph McGowan in 1998, 25 years after Jones' murder. When the former special agent interviewed him, he found himself sitting across from a man who was completely devoid of guilt or remorse as he even recounted the sickening details of the murder.
So in contrast to what he originally told psychiatrists in 1973, McGowan now denied having any history of sexual fantasies involving young girls, claiming his previous admissions about pedophilic fantasies were fabricated in an attempt to gain entry into a sex offender's unit because he'd been told that, quote, after a few years of therapy, they let you go. But despite this excuse, it was clear to John Douglas that McGowan had made little to no progress in confronting his pedophilic impulses and homicidal demons.
McGowan had even tried to attribute murdering Joan to the fact that, quote, Joan had knocked on his door during a moment of his despair where Joseph had been actively planning to kill himself for weeks but had been unable to follow through. McGowan was also claiming that when he saw Joan on the doorstep, quote, he became overwhelmed with unexplainable feelings of rage, saying, the doorbell rings, this poor little girl is standing there, and the thought that flashes across my mind, well, you can't kill yourself. Can you kill that?
McGowan was still refusing to address his motivations for committing these atrocities against Joan, especially in a way that would convince the parole board that he could maybe be rehabilitated. So by now, he'd acknowledged he lied to prior mental health professionals when asked if he had dated girls under 18 when he was an adult, having actually dated a 16-year-old student in 1970 when he was a teacher.
Oh my God.
Which is obscene, obviously. So clearly, this man had a breathtaking lack of insight into why he'd done what he did. He was also refusing to discuss the details of this crime.
John Douglas found out a lot of new information. It was in 98, and the head of the parole board, Andy Consovoy, at that time, had an opportunity to talk to him on another case. So he says, oh, can you just check this case out? There's lots of appeals going on, and it's a very big case, and I just would like your thoughts. And that's how John Douglas came into the case. And then John Douglas, what he did was interview Joan's killer for about at least 5 hours. I remember him saying that the killer's shirt was soaking wet from going to the place that time of when he killed Joan. And what he was telling psychologists wasn't really what happened at the door then. What it really was, it was that when he saw Joan, he knew he was going to kill her. And he was almost getting almost excited that he achieved what he wanted to do. And that was to destroy her completely, every single cell in her body. And then he did claim that he had slept well that night.
John Douglas went on to write about his interviews with Joan's killer, which were published in the book The Killer Across the Table, co-authored by Mark Olshaker.
Meanwhile, Rosemary's hard work at keeping Joan's memory alive through implementing legislative reform was really paying off. On April 3rd of 1997, former Governor Christy Whitman signed Joan's Law. Going forward, this meant anyone who murdered a child under 14 years of age, in conjunction with committing a sexual offense, would be imprisoned for life, with no chance of parole. Unfortunately, the law wouldn't apply to Joan's case because it wasn't retroactive. But it was a start. I mean, for Rosemary, it was so important that this not happen to other families.
On October 30th, 1998, President Bill Clinton signed a federal version of the legislation into law. That same year, which was the 25th anniversary of Joan's death, Rosemary created the Joan Angela D'Alessandro Memorial Foundation, a nonprofit devoting itself to child safeness, awareness, and advocacy.
This whole time, Rosemary had to keep attending McGowan's appeals and speaking at his parole hearings in an attempt to keep him behind bars, which was not only painful, but extremely unfair.
I wasn't one to give up easily, even though I never thought about it. I never thought, I'm not going to give up easily. I didn't think of it. It's just the way I was. I had to testify three times. And it was very hard. He was trying to prove that he paid for what he did. He should be out. And thank God we had the parole board that was doing the job that a parole board should be doing. There's no sense of, I did this, I'm sorry. I need to stay here. You know, I should not be even thinking of appeals. I should just take what I'm due, and this is even not enough for what I've done. Nothing of that.
Rosemary knew the only reason McGowan was able to keep funding his legal costs was due to an inheritance he'd received. So she decided to push for New Jersey's 2-year statute of limitations on victims' families suing convicted killers to be removed. Because if McGowan was sitting on a boatload of money, she should be able to sue him civilly for what he'd done to her daughter. And obviously, none of this was about money, but he should pay for what he did in every way, shape, or form. And he certainly shouldn't be able to use his money to try to get out of accountability for murdering a child. This new legislation, called the Justice for Victims Law, passed in November of 2000 and also applied to wrongful death actions brought in murder, manslaughter, and aggravated manslaughter cases.
And the first thing that Rosemary did was sue her daughter's killer, and she was awarded $750,000. He barely had any money left at this point, but again, it was about the principle. And Rosemary decided that any money that she got out of this person was going straight to the Jones Foundation to fund community education programs. And at this point, Rosemary was on a roll. 4 years later, in September of 2004, a version of Jones Law was signed by New York Governor George Pataki. The same year, Rosemary was honored for her hard work when she received the Attorney General's Special Courage Award.
Rosemary remained committed to doing everything humanly possible to keep her daughter's killer in prison. And in June of 2009, after an intense petition and letter campaign, McGowan's future eligibility term was increased to 30 years.
Rosemary was responsible for yet another legislative watershed when in July of 2017, Joan's Law in New Jersey was expanded to include victims under 18 years old. Rosemary is pretty much unstoppable at this point and is now working to have the same law in New York expanded. Except Rosemary wants the New York version of the law to be named Paula's Law.
So this is to honor the memory of 16-year-old Paula Bohaveski. Paula was murdered in October of 1980 by two men as she made her way home from her library job one evening in Pearl River, New York. Paula was sexually assaulted. She was stabbed and beaten. But the perpetrators weren't convicted of the sexual assault. One of Paula's killers had been released from prison, while the other continues to come up for parole, which obviously, over and over, puts Paula's family through absolute hell.
We're working on the expansion of Joan's Law in New York State, and it will be called Paula's Law because what it will do, it will extend the age of Joan's Law, which we got in New York State in 2004, so the expansion will be all minors, and that will be under 18. Paula was a teenager in New York State, in Rockland County, that lost her life. She was coming home from working at the library, and she was raped, and she was murdered. Next week, I will be having a meeting, a phone conversation with the senator, who's a sponsor, and then also the senator, the chairman of the Codes Committee, and to see if he'll think of putting it up for a vote.
Even 50 years later, vigils for Joan are still attended by many in the community who will never forget her, her legacy, or the superhuman efforts of her mother, Rosemary. This is proof that her killer never did destroy Joan's light, and it's how her mother has kept her alive all of these years. Joan's younger brother, John, is the vice president of the foundation, started in Joan's honor by her mom, and her brother, Michael, has also taken up the cause.
But Joan's spirit is so amazing. That's something I've never seen in my life, only with her, that I knew that he wasn't going to kill her all the way. Physically, yes, but every other way she was going to stay alive. And that shows after 50 years, it's still happening. Thank God I did it. That's what gives me such joy. If I didn't do it, I probably would have just covered my face. I would have not felt the way I feel now, being a voice. I do it because it's just the right thing to do. Just try my best that I can do. But really be a fighter with it too, because it's something I believe in. It's going to keep Joan's memory alive. It's going to help my family. It's going to help the community. But it's going to help everybody. So I believe in that bigger picture. So because I believe in that, and it starts with Joan, we don't forget Joan, but, you know, I'll fight for it.
Despite Joseph's repeated appeals, parole applications, and even trying to sue the state parole board, he never did get out of prison, dying in June of 2021, though the 75-year-old's cause of death really is not clear. And if you'd like to learn more about Joan's story and Rosemary's mission to have Joan's Law implemented across the country, you can visit the website jonesjoy.org. You can also purchase Rosemary's book, The Message of Light Amid Letters of Darkness, the proceeds of which go to the foundation, and we'll put a link in today's show notes. There's also a documentary in the works about Joan's case, so make sure you follow us on social media to get all of the updates about the release dates.
Rosemary's passion for advocating, not just for her own daughter, but for every child, is a true mark of her incredible resilience and strength. It would have been so easy for Rosemary to crawl into a ball and want to shut out the world forever to deal with the pain and anguish caused by the loss of Joan. Rosemary is undeniably a remarkable and inspiring woman. She never lost sight of being a devoted mother to her other children, but at the same time felt compelled to make a real difference so no one else would have to suffer with what her family still deals with today in losing Joan. There's no question that Rosemary's tenacity, dedication, and drive to ensure her daughter's spirit lives on is such a meaningful way she has saved lives and made the world a better place.
A huge thank you to Rosemary for being our first degree for today's episode. If you were listening out there and you have a story to tell, please email us hello@thefirstdegreepodcast.com. Follow us on Instagram, join our Facebook group. We're talking true crime all the time. Join our Patreon if you're looking for more first degree content, and stick around tomorrow. We'll have a brand new episode of Killing Time right in your feed.
And Rosemary, I hope we made you proud. We didn't curse a single time in this entire episode, which is actually big for us.
Yeah, it is.
We usually throw like an S word.
Yeah.
You know, just like a frivolous curse in there somewhere. And honestly, you're improving us. So we love you, Rosemary. Thank you so much again. Shout out to Jared Monaco for scoring original music for The First Degree, producing by Caitlin Cleveland, writing and research by Gemma Harris. Sources for this episode are Court Records, The New York Times, JonesJoy.org, The Bergen Record, The Journal News, NBC News, CBS, The Passock Press, and The New York Post. And as always, our First Degree guest, in this case, Rosemary, is always our largest source.
You ever meet someone who seems kind of off? Whether it's a creepy neighbor or random phone number that keeps calling you, Truth Finder has you covered. You can search for people by name, address, phone number, email, and more. Truth Finder can be especially helpful for running confidential background checks on anyone you're planning to meet from online dating apps. Go to truthfinder.com/podcasts for a special offer. That's truthfinder.com/podcasts to access your special offer today.